Welcome to episode 10 of Alan's Eyes and Ears. And hello, I'm Alan, sometimes known around these parts as Professor Alan, and I am your host. In this episode, we revisit the topic from our very first Eyes and Ears episode, lo, those 5 or 6 months ago. This is Book of Shadows, Movie Countdown 2. But first, a little feedback. Feedback from that very first movie countdown, as a matter of fact. And Sir Luke begins by realizing that he has some splainin' to do. Professor, over this past summer, around the time that I had reconstructive surgery on my right knee, my Podbean app decided that it was no longer going to notify me of new episodes for the podcasts to which I was subscribed. And as such, I'm a little behind on my shows. That said, I wanted to give some feedback on your inaugural episode of Eyes and Ears. Like you, I track the movies I watch each year. You are such a nerd, Luke. 2024 will mark the fourth consecutive year of film logging for me. Unlike you, I keep a simple chronological list. The fact that I keep it with pencil and paper would make it more difficult to slot films up in the method you described. Luke, that's why they invented erasers. Still, it is always enlightening to look back on the year and see what trends emerged from one's viewing. And I appreciated your insights into the films you discussed. A few specific comments. Mrs. Quarterbin and I are on the same page on Wonder Woman 1984, as I personally quite enjoyed it. Albeit, I do agree with you that the return of Steve Trevor was a hard pill to swallow. I thought the film captured the anything goes attitude of the pre-crisis Wonder Woman comics from the 1980s, and I very much enjoyed Kristen Wiig's turn as Barbara / Cheetah. I do not think it was better than the original, but I did enjoy it and have rewatched it several times. I will agree with you on one element there, Luke, and that is that the leading ladies, Gadot and Wiig, were certainly the film's strengths. As kids, my brother and I were both big fans of Conan the Destroyer. And as an adult, while I can recognize that Barbarian is the better-made film overall, there is a lot to like in Destroyer. I happened to catch it on cable this past year and was impressed at how well it holds up. If you would like, one could say that Barbarian tracks a bit closer to Robert E. Howard and Weird Tales, while Destroyer hews closer to Roy Thomas and Marvel Comics. The Martian War Machines from George Pal's War of the Worlds are one of the greatest cinematic spacecraft of all time, bar none. One of the books I read in 2023, Luke continues, was The Big Dark Sky by Dean Koontz. I won't get into the details, but a driving force in the novel is synchronicity, wherein events appear to be related despite having no causal relation. Since reading the book, I have been noticing more and more synchronicities in my life, and I'm not sure what to think of that. To wit, last year, I was reading a fanzine, which contained an article about the Curse of the Pink Panther, which was intended to relaunch the series with a new lead character following Peter Sellers' death in 1980. The article also details the earlier unfilmed Sellers-penned sequel, The Romance of the Pink Panther, and how much of that script ended up in either Trail of the Pink Panther or Curse. The article, which I found fascinating, kindled in me an interest in rewatching the Pink Panther series, favorites from my childhood, as my father is a fan. And here begins the synchronicity, Shortly thereafter, while reading a digital article on men's coats, the trench coat is discussed. The example used by the author, including an image, is of Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau. Next, while on the streaming service Max, a notification on the front page indicated that one of the just-added titles was The Pink Panther, along with the sequels. Soon afterwards, on my smart TV's Google TV home screen, one of the suggested titles was Inspector Clouseau, the 1968 film with Alan Arkin playing the title character, which I have never seen, and reviews suggest that was a good call. Next, my brother Jason, along with my niece Haley, released a Christmas episode of his show, Bots, Bugs, and Babes, covering the animated TV special A Pink Christmas. And now here in the start of 2024, I hear you talk about the Pink Panther and A Shot in the Dark. Again, no causal relation between all these events, and yet they all happened within a span of just a few months. Is it any surprise I'm taking a hard look at the Shout Factory Pink Panther box set on Amazon? Regardless of the meaning, or lack of meaning, of these synchronicities, I enjoyed hearing your thoughts and found myself both agreeing and disagreeing with you. Very much looking forward to whatever comes next, as well as hopefully reconvening to talk about another set of movies in the future. Until next time, I remain your devoted listener, Luke. We'll talk about synchronicities, friend. You, not being notified of the episodes, listening to this one 4 to 5 months after its initial release, enabled you to send in email on our first movie discussion episode about 36 hours before recording our second movie episode. How about that? It's freaky, dude. That's all I can say. On your specific comments, glad to know that the Sellers movies have ended up on Max. All I knew was that they had disappeared from Prime before I got much further into the series. Also, glad to have you confirm, although not completely agree with, my thoughts on Conan the Destroyer. On episode 6, the road trip episode involving our work/family vacation to New England, Chief Fanhole Derek WC, perfectly hit on the key moment of that episode. The best part of number 6, the free shuttle ride to the hotel. Exactly, Derek. Exactly. On episode 8, I talked about the possible pitfalls for the podcast network that could arise in the future based on the technologies that we use, and Pat Sampson from the Longbox Crusade reached out to recommend some other options and also offered to help in that transition if it was ever needed in the future. Thank you, Pat. Very kind. Also on that episode, my former coworker, Drew, from Comics for Fun and Profit, commented on X Twitter that he was jealous of my record-keeping skills regarding my reading lists. I pointed out that as a marketer, he actually has the advantage of not having the antisocial personality so common among CPAs like myself. So maybe he still got the better end of that trade-off. And then last episode, that was about Christmas and the Puerto Rico collection. And Sir Manuel Carmona listened right away as soon as he saw Puerto Rico was in the name of the episode. Happy New Year, Professor Allen. As always, episode 9 was so much fun. What an amazing gift your wife and daughter gave you. I'll make sure my wife listens to the episode and maybe she'll get some ideas. As for the road trip, it sounded like my family's road trips with all the used bookstore and antique shop visits. I make sure to scout whichever town we're visiting beforehand to see if there are any comic shops or used bookstores. I always find a few. Genius, Manuel, genius. You cannot be too prepared for such a circumstance. Last but not least, thanks in advance for your contributions to our Comics for Christmas initiative. We'll make sure to pass any comics received along to as many kids as we can. Have a great one, and as always, keep the pages turning. Sincerely, Manuel. Thank you, friend. Thank you. Billy D's response was similar, albeit a bit briefer. Professor, you are blessed. Fun episode, and it was great to hear M. Thank you, Billy, and I agree on all counts. And Sir Martin wrote in on that episode as well. Hi, Alan. What a lovely Christmas present from Valerie, and how lovely of M to be such an excellent co-conspirator. I smiled on hearing that you sat down and did the maths around price per unit and what you made reselling the odd issue in order to get a mean figure. The project is like a gift within a gift. And what a brilliant selection of titles. I'd be particularly excited about the 100-page Super Spectaculars, undoubtedly the greatest comic book format. Oops, that comment just got my next appearance on Treasury Cast canceled. Best of most, Mart. Gift within a gift. Yes, Mart, I love that explanation. It is completely accurate. And Sir Dr. Ange commented as well, sounds like a great holiday season, Professor. You and I talk sports a lot. But college football is not a big deal here in New England, so the thrill of a bowl game, even a minor one, is not a sensation I'm familiar with. But I am glad you two were able to go and even witness a victory. The Puerto Rico collection sounds like the world's best Christmas gift. And yes, organizing and stacking and recalibrating it was probably as much fun as receiving it, and was so right to not put them completely in order, leaving that to you as part of the project. True kudos to Val and M for putting it all together. And how wonderful that you returned the true gems of the collection back to the man to turn around himself. It would have been easy for someone less moral to keep his hands on those wall books. Can't wait to hear about all the issues you kept. Thank you, Ange. And thank you, everybody, both M and Valerie. Appreciate the love you showered on both of them as well after hearing the episode. Yes, they were the true stars of this whole holiday season. And as Billy said, I am blessed. That last episode received social media appreciation from Sir Martin of Grey, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Chris from Professor Frenzy, Dave's Comic Hero Blog, Ed from Teal Productions, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Sir Iowa's Joe, the notorious JJG, Chris Lydon 7, Evan Bevins, Asterix 51, Sean Urbanski, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Corbin Owens, Roger Preeb, Star Trek fan Jonathan Bradford, Professor Chuck from the Bowling Green Pop Culture Studies Department, Shane Kelly, Matt McKeegan, Ranger Gord, David Ace Gutierrez, Vic and Phoenix, and the Stop Let's Team Up podcast. And that must mean that it's time to take a break and play a promo, and when I come back, I'll be talking about the movies I've recently watched. And I won't be alone.
Hey everybody, Quentin Robison here. I recently attempted to sneak into the Longbox Crusade headquarters basement to watch some of the Albrecht Brothers action movies while the crew was out at the Saturday matinee theater. Too bad I had a little mishap and got stuck down here. With no movies to boot! However, there are pieces of Pat's old podcasting equipment and excellent Wi-Fi service, so I decided to pass the time watching online fan films and talking about them. What, you don't know what a fan film is? Well, there are these non-theatrical movies that people post online of already established characters and settings. Hey now, just wait and see. Save all judgment for what happens when you listen to Fan Film Fridays, a new podcast found on the Longbox Crusade podcast feed.
And we're back. And by we, I don't just mean me and a huge stack of VHSs, because I am joined by a friend of the network who's one of the biggest fans of film that I know, from the frozen tundra of New England. It's Dr. Ange.
Well, I can't thank you enough for bringing me on in. Most of the movies I watch are off of Turner Classic Movies these days. And so looking at your list, there are some I'm going to be able to talk about at length, and others I'm going to have to say pass.
I just thought it would be fun to shake up the format for this style of episode, use it this time as a chance to have a conversation instead of just a monologue. I mean, you've sort of hinted at this already, but just to give opportunity to listeners to get to know you as a movie guy, not just a Supergirl and comics guy. Let me ask it a multiple choice question. I'm an expert at this. Okay. So please allow me. I got three choices here. If you were to get a movie theme tattoo, okay, would it be Alfred Hitchcock's silhouette, the Oscar award, you know, statuette, or the TCM logo?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think I might go with the Hitchcock silhouette as more interesting. You know, it's funny, I have no tattoos. And as I've told people, I don't know if I believe in anything strongly enough to indelibly dye it to my skin. But when you posed the question before, as I was thinking, maybe like the Maltese Falcon would be an interesting one. Right. Little statue. Yep.
Whatever it would be, the tattoo itself would be in black and white. We know that.
Yes, yes.
Is that your primary, I don't know if that's a genre, but the black and white / noir film, is that your specialty?
You know, it's funny. I tell people I'm a fan of film, but I'm also a movie fan. So my first job was in a movie theater as a teenager and worked there for 6 years. So anything pretty much between 1985 and 1992, I've seen. And as a kid, I was like a Friday the 13th Hellraiser slasher kind of a guy, was introduced to old movies by my dad. And so over the course of my life, I've kind of veered more towards classic movies and kind of like really trying to think about things. But I'll also sit down and watch the most idiotic thing just because I just like movies. And it's funny, I'll tell people, I'm like, boy, I'm like an hour and 15 minutes into this terrible movie. And they're like, you know, you can turn it off. And I'm like, but how do I know the last 45 minutes aren't the like best, you know, representation of cinema ever I have to watch? So I'm kind of I'll watch almost anything. I like action movies. I like sci-fi. But I guess like if you ask me, like, what is my big love now? It would probably be classics and probably film noir. I watch as much as I can.
I do owe you one, actually, because I can't remember how this happened. But back in the early days of the COVID lockdowns when we had nothing but time on our hands. And again, how this worked out, but I don't know if I sent you a screenshot of TCM's upcoming schedule or whatever it was, but you heartily recommended the 1944 movie Laura, starring the luminous Jean Tierney. And I owe you for that one.
Yeah, that's absolute 100% classic. That's got such a great cast. Obviously, I'm a huge Jean Tierney fan. Like, My hope is to meet her in the afterlife. But Dana Edwards is in that, and Clifton Webb is in that. Vincent Price is in that.
It's a non-creepy Vincent Price, which is kind of creepy.
Yes, yes. He kind of plays like a cad. He's like, he hits on every woman that enters the screen with him. And the woman that played like the creepy maid in Hitchcock's Rebecca, I'm blanking on the actress's name, is also in it. But that's probably where I fell in love with Gene Tierney and remain in love with Gene Tierney and have seen every Gene Tierney movie I can. Yeah.
To me, one of the indelible elements of that movie, including being introduced to your girlfriend, Gene Tierney, was the character of Lydecker, who's like a gossip columnist.
Yes.
And he writes his columns on a typewriter, resting across a board over his bathtub. And I'm just saying, this is a move I totally respect. This is my dream job.
He's so fascinating, right? Everything in his apartment is like pristine and beautiful and like museum quality. And he's very, very upper crust. He's like exactly the type of guy I would want to kick between the legs. Like that whole movie, I'm like, he is such a jerk. And that's part of it, right? He has the detective walks in to interview him, and he's in his like four-legged bathtub with the elegant table over where that has the typewriter. I mean, it's a boss move, no doubt. But
this is why sometimes the old manual approaches are the way to handle things. You not want to take a chance with your $1,200, $1,800 tablet, and of course, nothing plugged in. So this is. It's a perfect encapsulation of nailing it in that era, I think.
Yeah.
Now, there are no black and white films in this countdown, but I do understand that you had watched a majority of the films on this list.
Yeah, when you sent me the 21 movies that are on this list, I kind of put a red hash mark next to them. I think it's something like 15 out of the 21.
Yeah.
And even of the six that I haven't seen, I probably have something to say. So we'll get through this. It'll be a lot of fun.
Like the first time we did this back in episode 1 of Alan's Eyes and Ears, this is the American Top 40 style, a countdown counting up to number 1, although no long distance dedications. And this is depending really on you, Ange. No expletive laden rants that will become radio history. So
I'll do my best.
So here we have it. The final 21 movies that I watched in 2023. And the first five of these, I'm going to qualify as movies I didn't really like. So these would be in the thumbs down category or the rotten category, depending how old you are in terms of your movie review references. Now, for me, the source of most of my movies are often free cable package previews. So that's where a bunch of these come from. Also, the regular movie channels, a couple streaming sites that we subscribe to. And sometimes there are themes for what these channels show. So, for example, when the fifth Indiana Jones film was coming out, one of the cable channels showed the first four. And I set my DVR to record them all, or at least I thought I did, because somehow the schedule was off by a bit. And I don't know, maybe this was when we did that fallback time change. I don't know, but I only ended up recording fully the third and fourth of the films. So those are the ones on this list. And you may be wondering what such a beloved franchise has to do with the bottom of this list. And I'm sorry, it's number 21, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, I don't even like to admit this movie exists, right? I think it goes 1, 2, 3, 5 for the Indiana Jones. I'm a big Indiana Jones fan, I'll tell you. Like, I Love the first three movies. I used to watch the Young Indiana Jones television show. I actually read, they came out with like a bunch of like, you know, paperback novels that were probably for like 14-year-old boys. I'm 22 reading them, you know, because I love the character that much and I wanted to get as much as I possibly could. And to be honest with you, I don't know if I've ever sat down and watched it all the way through because I've heard so much about it, but I've seen, I would say, probably about 80% of it in bits and pieces as I've turned it on. It's very clear this was like, this will be the last one, and Shia LaBeouf, of all people, will take over, and it just doesn't work. I don't think the science fiction part of it sort of works for this character in some ways. So I think for me, the less said, the better, or I might go into a rant.
Yeah, because again, you know, when I first saw this, the part I liked least was Shia LaBeouf and the obvious attempt to backdoor pilot him into being, you know, the new face of the franchise. And he's sort of a divisive figure in a lot of ways, you know, certainly at the time. But I thought maybe 15 years in the rearview mirror, I could take a clear-eyed, objective view of the film. And it just wasn't there. I mean, I know why they did Aliens in the 1950s setting, post-Roswell, Alien Mania and all that, but just not for me. Now, we will have another chance to talk about the franchise. And fortunately, Harrison Ford is sprinkled throughout this countdown as well. So this is not the last that we will have heard of him. So, and on the first time that I did this, talked about the first two Pink Panther movies. We also just revisited those in the feedback section. And sadly, that brings us to number 20, The Return of the Pink Panther from 1975. I was really looking forward to this one as I have fond memories of these 70s Clouseau movies. This one was just too silly, and there just wasn't enough there for me. I mean, the plot just wasn't that smart. The humor wasn't as smart. And, you know, the fact that this is this far down the list, probably there's a heightened expectations thing there. But I do think it was far weaker than the prior two. And I did say this in the feedback section, but these movies are now on Max, which I don't have, instead of on Prime, where I saw these ones. So I probably won't be getting back to them for a while, but it is my firm belief that Strikes Again and the other ones were much better than this one. At least I hope they were.
You know, I can't say 100% that I've seen this one. I watched a lot of the Pink Panther movies there. You know, I grew up in a time where, you know, Channel 6 between 4 and 6 ran a movie, right? You know, and they had Pink Panther Week, and I'm sure that I watched it. And as a kid, I can remember thinking that these were high comedy and hysterical. I've tried to revisit them now that I'm a little bit older, and I think I struggle a little bit because I do think at times they veer into, this is a two-hour Three Stooges, and that is best served as a 8-minute short. I'll tell you, my girlfriend loves Peter Sellers, has this as like a DVD collection, and swears by the first one. That's the one with Robert Wagner, I think, right?
Yes.
Which is excellent. That one I rewatched and I was like, oh, I can see. But I think I'm with you, at least by recollection, they kind of become more parodies of themselves, I think, than anything else. And it's going to sound crazy, but I'm kind of a Herbert Lom fan. Anywhere you find Herbert Lom, he played the Phantom of the Opera in a Phantom of the Opera film that I've seen. So you can almost see that he's like, I had a mortgage payment to make. I used to be a respected actor. I'll sign me up. I'll do as many of these as I can.
And then talk about Out of the Blue. Number 19, Barely Lethal. And when I sat down to watch this nothing burger of a 2015 movie on a miscellaneous cold day during winter break when I had nothing to do, in my defense, I kind of figured it would be destined to be absolute rock bottom on this list. It's that kind of dumb movie. And give it a little credit. It is 19th out of 21. That's something. And it's basically Harry Potter meets the League of Assassins. School for secret agents, you know, special op kids, you know, that's the That's the vibe. The strength of it is the cast. Haley Steinfeld plays the lead, a gal who escaped spy school and is now trying to fit in regular high school. Sophie Turner, Jessica Alba are also in the cast. It's not a good movie. It's predictable. It's paint by numbers. But it didn't anger me like Crystal Skull or disappoint me like the Pink Panther. So, you know, Ange, sometimes low expectations can be your friend.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one. It doesn't sound like I'm going to seek it out. I opened it up just to see what it was about. And you're right. I mean, so at least on internet, it lists Dove Cameron as the like the top actress. She was a huge Disney TV show. Right. Like I recognize her because when my kids were younger, they watched shows with her on it. She seemed like somebody that was going to be destined to like break out of Disney and become a megastar. She hasn't. Obviously, Haley Steinfeld, you know, she was a True Grit. She was Hawkeye, right? She's been in a bunch of good things. Sophie Turner, Jean Grey. So I think you're right. Like, you know, you had me at Jessica Alba. You throw in these other people, right? at least, you know, I get the sense that I won't seek it out, but should this be on USA Network at 2:01 afternoon, I'll probably watch it.
There's a good chance. There's a good chance that's about where you'd find it. And then a live action take on a cartoon from my childhood, a cartoon that I absolutely loved. Although growing up, I don't have any recollections of actual cartoon episodes. What I mostly remember having memories of is singing the awesome theme song. So from 2008, from the Wachowskis, number 18, Speed Racer. And I know that this movie elicits strong feelings on both sides. And from our brief pre-conversation, I believe that you have strong feelings, although I don't know what they are. Oh. So, Doctor, the floor is yours.
Of the 21 films that you have listed here, I would probably put this at number one, my favorite.
Nice. Awesome.
So first of all, I think that your comment about expectations is huge. If you go into a movie with the highest expectations and it's average, you're going to rate it a D and not a C. And if you go into a movie with no expectations, which I did with Speed Racer, it was on either Cinemax or Showtime, whatever thing that we had at the time. I was kind of a little bit disillusioned with the Wachowskis at that point because they had put out a couple of movies that just didn't resonate with me. And I was like, whatever. And I was 100% blown away by this movie. First of all, from a visual point of view, it is stunning. It is just, I feel like, years ahead of its time when you look at the effects that it has. The second thing I'll say is, overall, the story that percolates through is Speed is being, you know, seduced or lured to cheat and become a pawn in a huge cheating scandal that has major economic issues, and how his family are like, no, we're going to stay true to our morals. That's just the way that we do things. And that is all the way through, obviously, until you can imagine that there's going to be a happy ending at the end. Mm-hmm. And again, the cast in this, John Goodman, Susan Sarandon, Emil Hirsch, Christina Ricci, Matthew Fox, amazing cast. The storyline in and of itself is told through a series of flashbacks about his brother and how his brother was lured and did his brother got killed and all these sort of things. And it's a, you know, my kids were probably 8 when they saw it. The opening scene is him chasing his brother's record and you kind of see the ghost car of the brother and how he's chasing that record. That's some heavy storytelling. Like my 8-year-old was like, I don't understand what's going on. You pause, let me explain to you what they're trying to say. So there are these high adult, like, how I'm going to tell you this part of the story. And then in the middle of it, there's like the Speed Racer stuff. The car opens up the back hatch and it has a catapult with a beehive on it and dumps it into the car next door, right? And there are all these crazy car battles with crazy weapons. And so the essence of the lunacy of the original cartoon is there. This high-minded story of like, stay true to your morals, good wins out, is just there. Crazy visuals. I saw it on Showtime. I went out, I bought it on DVD, right? You know, I was like, this movie is amazing. So I will die on that hill that people who have not seen this should see it.
I believe you will have company there in our friend Stella, who, if memory serves, is a huge fan of this one as well. And for me, I'm just not sure what it was. Maybe further up the list, we have more sports movies.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe part of that is that in my mind, I'm putting this in the category of a auto racing sports movie.
Yeah.
And that part of it is so fantastical and so silly, really. That's, to me, that's part of where the disconnect of the cartoon and the serious stuff is for me. So, I mean, you and I have talked about it when things that we know about are portrayed in pop culture. Usually it's our professions.
Yeah.
Right. We struggle. And so, I mean, it hits, you know, business and finance and stuff, but also religion and theology and church history, but also sports. And it's like, I think I'm probably overly sensitive. I think it might be that element as much as the, this is a beloved childhood franchise thing. So I think it might be those two potential areas sort of colliding. And so there was nowhere for me to jump on in terms of getting into this film, acknowledging the craft behind it for sure. No questions about that.
I would be fascinated if you ever watch it again, focus more on the finance piece, which I think might fascinate you more, because they do say things like, we have rigged this race so this car will win, so that the stock of that company will go up, and then they can merge with this other company to become a mega conglomerate to control this. Like, there, it's like this very layered story, again, in the middle of, we threw a snake in the other guy's car and he crashed off a mountain, right? You know, so there's no doubt it is not for everybody. And I do see lovers and haters. I don't see anybody who ever says, like, you know, it was okay.
Agreed.
You either agree it or you don't get it.
Agreed. That reminds me, but that was the old saying, at least I heard in NASCAR, at least between the Ford and the Chevy, you know, as your two major constructors for a long time, it was win on Sunday, sell on Monday.
Yeah.
So there's that direct connection. All right. Next up, and so far this is the third time this has happened already, it's a later film in a franchise. So this is number 17, Men in Black International from 2019. And I've liked a lot of Chris Hemsworth's work when he's not Thor, including his work in this film. But the movie, this was just a bunch of blah. An example of a film nobody was clamoring for. Nobody was demanding this. But it just didn't really need to be made, if that, you know, that makes sense. There was just sort of no reason to make this one.
I saw the first Men in Black and liked it. I saw the second Men in Black and kind of thought it was okay, and then this one came out and I basically said, I know, without, you know, Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith to really sort of bring me in, I felt that this was like one dip too many into the pond. And I'll tell you, it's funny for me, because usually if I like get into sequels, I am heavily into sequels, and so like I'm like, I've seen all 9 Hellraiser movies, right? Like, why? Well, you know, you see the 5, you want to follow what happened. So it was, again, I feel that this is one of those ones that at some point is going to cross my path on a television, and I'll probably be like, okay. I agree with you. I like Chris Hemsworth. I think Tessa Thompson's in this, right? Mm-hmm. I like Tessa Thompson a lot. So, but I think that the actual Men in Black piece of it just doesn't get me. I mean, when you hear every single movie is being remade because Hollywood has no good ideas, why not go back to Men in Black?
Then this point is where we move from movies that were in the negative. This would be your thumbs up. So barely fresh, we would say number 16, Dread. This is the 2012 one starring Carl Urban. And it's a simple story. It's well done, though. Simplicity of the style, the filmmaking works well to tell such a simple story. And I've read a reasonable amount of Dredd stories, nothing crazy, a decent amount. And as much as I like Dredd as a character, my favorite judge is Side Judge Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a significant character in this story. And as much as I did like it, it is really, really simple. Plot was simple. Character interactions were pretty simple as well. It lacked ambition, but it's good. And thinking about it now after the fact, it might deserve to be a couple spots higher on the list.
Yeah, you know, I'll say we've had two Judge Dredd movies, one with Sylvester mm-hmm. Stallone and one with this one with Carl Urban. This one, I think, is 10 times as good as the other one. I think this one is really solid. And I think it treats itself seriously, which I think is probably one of the things that, like, in a time when the Avengers will, like, let's go out for shawarma, there ain't no time for that in Judge Dredd. This is heavy dystopia, and you feel it. But I'm with you. I think this is very well done. The story is not, as you say, you know, too tricky, but I felt very immersed in that world. I think you understood the world that he was living in, and I think he killed it. I mean, like when like you, I'm not I have omnibuses of Judge Dredd. I have like smatterings of history yeah. with reading him, but that is exactly how I would anticipate him acting is the way that Urban portrayed him. And so I just thought this one worked. This is one that, again, you see crop up. If this is on, I'll put it on yeah. in the background, even if it's just noise while I'm ironing shirts or something like that. Like mm-hmm. this is good enough for many brief visits. Mm-hmm. I think it's really solid.
Agreed. And again, another example of a genre we visited a few times so far, which is to say a later entry in a film series. From 2007, Live Free or Die Hard. And I was a fan of Moonlighting, Ange, from all the way back in season one, and have always had the softest of soft spots for Bruce Willis, even his less good roles in movies. I almost always find something winsome about him, appealing about his performances. This, not the last time, we'll have our chance to talk about Bruce Willis on this list, by the way. But right there, what are your feelings on Bruce Willis as a actor and a star? And what are your feelings on the Die Hard franchise?
We are certainly of a certain age, Professor Allen, and it is very clear why we're friends, because huge fan of Moonlighting. And I can tell you, Sherman's at the Wayback Machine. Like, I used to tell my friends, don't call me on the landline Wednesdays between 9 and 10. I am watching Moonlight. Even if you call, I'm going to tell, hang up, right? You know, so I love Moonlighting. And I feel, it's funny, that recently, it's on one of the streaming services now. And, and Anna and I have been watching it. And I say, you know, it is very clear that David Addison had a very important impact on my personality. The sarcasm and snark, you know, puns and all that sort of stuff. Like, clearly I thought he was the coolest guy in the world and I should be like him. And so, like you, I followed Bruce Willis to movies. Now, here's where, not having seen Barely Lethal, I might have put it one notch above Live Free or Die Hard, because I love Die Hard and I love John McClane. I'll tell you the problem with this one is it has become super fantastical. When you watched Die Hard, yeah. you thought he could get shot, his feet got cut up, right? Like he was in true danger. This, I just think, you the know, superhero. car goes off a highway ramp, falls 200 feet, is smashed, he gets up, walks out. So I think I'll watch Die Hard 100 times before I watch Live Free or Die Hard. But you're right. I mean, I think I would still classify myself as a big Bruce Willis fan. But lots of other films I'd put ahead of this.
Yeah. I mean, this one, I think Justin Long is an actor. I kind of like Maggie Q.
Is
good in this. So I think it's a sort of a pretty well put together A to B to C dumb action film. But I think Willis there enables that the balance between drama and humor, between danger, although, as you said, for him, it's not really danger.
Yeah.
But the danger and fun that I like from him. Now, here we reach the first of our two Marvel movies. Number 14, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And I'll say I really liked the first one. My strong dislike of Benedict Cumberbatch's attempted American accent aside, I mean, yuck. And I think what this one suffered from was less specific about the movie than just about the state of the Marvel U into which this movie was inserted, the multiverse saga. It's just, it just wasn't working well for me. I don't think I'm alone in that. And in that setting, Cumberbatch's attempted American accent I found to be really grating because the overall rest of the film was dragging me down too. And I actually don't know if I've heard you talk much about the Marvel movies. So the floor is yours again.
I think that this one is right where it should be in terms of rank. So I saw WandaVision and on Disney, and that's a tragic story about the Scarlet Witch, obviously. And I think that one of the things that detracts from this for me is that she is a very lovable character. She is a character that you empathize with, and she is made unmistakably evil in this movie. And I think that it's when you like the villain, or when the whole movie are going like, she doesn't deserve this, then it makes it hard to really get invested. Like, I don't want her to be the bad guy, right? Now, there was plenty of Easter eggs for comic fans, right? So, I mean, the idea of the multiverse, you know, like, we embrace that. We like that. Oh, the zombie-verse, right? And a lot of that was also hinted at in the Disney television What If series, right? So to see Captain Carter come out with the Illuminati and Patrick Stewart as Professor X again. And then, oh my gosh, there's John Krasinski, who every fan in the world thinks should play that stretchy guy. And so, like, there were moments in it that were like, oh, this is pretty cool, right? We're seeing, like, the Marvel Illuminati, and we're seeing, like, different representations of really big characters, like Black Bolt. Oh, my gosh. But I do think this one suffers a little bit because I think of all of the characters in the movie, the one that I was rooting for, not for her evil stuff, but in just her, was the Scarlet Witch. And as a result, it tarnishes the movie a little bit, right? But I mean, you're a big Scarlet Witch fan, right? She's been put through the ringer by many writers. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
I mentioned earlier when we talked about the Indiana Jones movie that they replayed, you know, the prior ones before the new one came out. And similarly, before the fourth Expendables flick came out in the fall, the first three were replayed back to back. And since I'd never seen them, I watched them all. And of those first three, although I enjoyed them all to varying degrees, my least favorite was here at 13, the Expendables 3. Again, you know, not bad. I'll talk about the other ones later in the episode when we get to the other two movies. Now, I remember when we started talking about this episode, you had not seen any of the Expendables. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's still the case. And I'll tell you, I'm actually going to be rapt listening to you. So the first thing I'm going to say is, I honestly thought it was a side stream from the Fast and the Furious movies.
That's fair.
So, and I haven't seen any of them. And I'm like, why would I like see the side gig of that? The truth is, when I look, right, these are all of the action heroes, all of the action stars that I love. I grew up with, right? So it's like, I love the Transporter movies. Oh my God, Sly Stallone, like Tango and Cash, right? Like all of that sort of stuff. And so my guess is that they're an absolute hoot. My guess is this is, let's order Domino's and watch the Expendables, right?
Exactly.
But I haven't seen them, and so to see you rank the three of them where you ranked them is very intriguing to me. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on
them. Yeah. There's something about the Stallone and Jason Statham, that combo, that works for me. The casual friendship that they have, that the trust that these two characters have is really well portrayed. And I like that in each film, some time has passed. There's a specific, you know, new job that they're doing. And so the team changes. There's an excuse for cast changes sort of built into it. And this one, Kelsey Grammer, okay, wait, before you say anything, he's the talent scout for the team, that's all. But between them, they end up recruiting Antonio Banderas, which is also more of a running joke in the film as well. Ronda Rousey and others. Jet Li and Wesley Snipes are in this one. Mel Gibson is the bad guy. And they're done well enough for me to be fun. But again, we can talk more about the franchise in a few minutes. Here we have another Marvel movie, though not part of the Marvel universe cinematically. This is from the world of the X-Men from 2013, number 12, The Wolverine. This is the one that takes Logan to Japan, telling, you know, that version of his story. And I really like the comic version of that story and thought that this movie telling of it was pretty good too. Again, what is your history with the X-Men and in any medium?
You know, I had a group of comic book nerds that I were friends with in high school, and there were several huge X-Men fans that were all like more Marvel, and I was obviously right, more DC. Right. So I read all those books. We lived in the same college dorm room, right? And so we shared comic books all the time. The first X-Men comic book that I said I collected monthly was Grant Morrison's New X-Men. But I read enough of the Wolverine stuff to be excited for this movie when I saw the trailers, right? Like that image of him like perforated with arrows that have ropes and ninjas and, oh, we're going to get Mariko and all of that sort of side of the of that story I was excited to see. I felt this one, this is a perfect spot for it, smack in the middle.
In
right?
the middle,
it's like,
yeah.
It's an enjoyable movie. It certainly didn't blow me away. Like, I would say, like, X2, I think, yeah, is far and away the best X-Men movie for me. There's also, like we talked about before, the guy is like, I have to harvest Wolverine's bone marrow to give myself a bone marrow transplant to become immortal. And yeah, he sucks the marrow out of one of his claws. And I'm like, it's such a tiny bone. Like, wouldn't you do the femur, right? Like, so there was like a little bit of medicine in it. And I'm like, why is he dying? It's not like all of the marrow is connected because like that bone ends, right? So once you start thinking real life medicine in an X-Men movie, you know that that's problematic. I'm sure that I'm a subset of people thinking about bone marrow transplants and how they work. But there we are. Number 12. Perfect.
Now, during this general time frame, the first three James Bond movies were again all back to back on one of the streamers or one of the cables or whatever it was. And as of this point, I've only watched the first two so far. So there are two in this countdown. And right here is the first one, number 11, Dr. No. And I really like Connery in the role, obviously, a lot. But a little bit like the Pink Panther movies last time I talked about those films, it's like the first one of these wasn't as strong, partly because they hadn't quite figured out that they were making a Bond film and what a capital B Bond, capital F film trademark had to be, what it was going to be. And you can certainly argue that a template, a formula, which they were fumbling their way towards, that becomes a hamper. You know, drag on the series maybe down the road. But here with film one, there were some Bond elements that just weren't quite there yet.
I'm a Connery guy, and I think you're right. I think what happens when you have somebody who plays James Bond is at some point it just becomes too ludicrous and it's time to reboot, right? When it's like, yeah, I have an invisible car that I'm driving in Antarctica, right? It's like, oh, okay, like we're even stretching it even for me. And so I think you're right. This is almost like the Petri dish of Bond. We see some of what he's going to be, but we don't see all of what he's going to be in movies. And we haven't reached the other end of the extreme.
Right.
I mean,
right,
but this is Ursula Andress coming out of the water, right?
Yes.
You know, yes, and so when you talk about like images that are seared in the brain of pop culture, her coming out with that white bikini and the knife and all that's looks like that's what a Bond girl is, right? We got that part right, and I think Connery being you know, a little bit of a brawler, but also very suave. We got that part right. And so I think they were learning. I really like Dr. No. I'll watch it every time I see it.
Yeah. Number 10, Jane Eyre, the 2011 version. I like British literature. And even though this book is not written by Thomas Hardy, I still like it. That one's for you, Stell, even though I know you don't listen. Now, I tend to slightly prefer the Brontes over Jane Austen. And this is rightly a classic novel. And I don't want to speak for Jane Eyre super fans like Stella. But I thought this one was a solid adaptation, well cast. Mia Wasikowska as Jane, Michael Fassbender as Rochester, and Jamie Bell as St. John. So take it wherever you want to. How do you feel about classic literature adaptations?
Yeah, you know, I'll say that it's always good for me to watch them and sort of compare and contrast. And I'll say that the Jane Eyre podcast that Stella did was super fascinating because I think I read this book once in like my sophomore year of college, right? And I've yet to pick it back up. And I always say, like, I should probably reread that. And it just never gets there. Certainly the cast of this one looks like it's super solid. I haven't seen this one. I'm always thrilled to hear mega fans talk about stuff. So like Siskoid talking about Hamlet on Fire and Water, and Stella talking about Jane Eyre and all of the different versions of it. I think really when I hear somebody being super passionate about something, it actually makes me feel sort of passionate about it in a way that I'm like, I need to explore this. So I'll ask you, because I'm sure there have been other film versions of Jane Eyre, is this the one I should seek out?
Well, for a lot of these, the basic rule is, whether it's a Jane Eyre or a Jane Austen, you look for the 4 to 6 hour British TV, BBC or ITV, whatever, those adaptations. Those are always the better ones, just because there's a little more that you can do in 4 hours or six hours than you can do in an hour 45. So that's almost always the case.
I will look for that. But really, I should pick up the book first. It's sort of a, you know, I feel like I need to like turn in my liberal arts education card since I can't speak about it at length.
Now, we mentioned this franchise already, and this is the first one. Number 9, The Expendables from 2010. Stallone and Statham, Jet Li, Dolph Lundgren, Terry Crews, Eric Roberts, Bruce Willis. It's not great, but it's not bad. Action stars doing action. Decent plot ranging from Somali pirates to overthrowing a Central American dictator. Again, not a lot to say on this one other than pretty fun.
Terry Crews is in it?
He is in and out of them. I don't know if he's in every one.
Well, I mean, you're making me more interested with each subsequent discussion that we have. So, all right, I'm going to have to start scoping things out.
Now, for this next one, I have a story to tell, a very vague connection to this, which may bias me strongly in favor of this film. So I will let you go first. Your thoughts on my number 8, the Jackie Robinson film 42.
Yeah, I'm a huge baseball fan. I'm a huge fan of Jackie Robinson. And I thought that this movie was really great. I thought this movie was like really, really fantastic. And it's hard for me to separate. Like, if you ask me, like, what's your favorite baseball movie? It's going to be Bull Durham or The Natural. If you ask me, but like, what about real baseball? I mean, it's going to be tough between 8 Men Out, 42. I mean, those
Eight
are
Men Out is terrific. Yeah,
those are great movies. But this one, I think, was one. I mean, perfect. Like the cast is phenomenal. Somebody should put this in a time capsule and say this is what historical sports movies should be like.
Right. And first and foremost, I thought the baseball was done pretty well, and not just the on the field stuff, but also that's certainly part of it. But they seem to understand the game, understand different positions, what the manager and the general manager and the owner, sort of the almost that detail-oriented stuff that, again, as a sports guy, as a baseball fan, you could easily get booted from a film if either they clearly don't understand the game or they don't know how to direct the actors well enough, which is also the same thing as saying they don't understand. you don't know what a swing looks like. You don't know what a pickoff play looks like. You don't know what a ground ball to shortstop is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
But they get all that stuff correct. Now, this factoid, this skipped a generation, this skipped me, but both my father and M, they both went to Ohio Wesleyan University.
Oh.
Whose most famous alumni? Branch Rickey.
Oh.
The man who brought Jackie Robinson to the Dodgers. And he is played in this film by Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And Ohio Wesleyan does get a shout out in the movie. And so that is my bias in favor of the film. But again, I just think it got so much correct.
Obviously, super important story to tell, right? Super important to hear about the struggles that he had and how he rose above and all that sort of stuff. It very easily could have become preachy, right? Yeah. Or it very easily could have become like hammer-fisted. And it's not. It's just telling his story in a way that is both truthful and impactful and entertaining, right? It's a movie. It's supposed to entertain you in some way, right. but I just thought that this was just spectacular.
Back again, third time's a charm. Number 7, The Expendables 2. And again, there's something about the second film in a franchise. You're able to build on those existing relationships. You have some elements that can be returned to, running jokes that can continue, but you aren't stuck with a formula just yet. So to me, there's often something about the second film that can actually lift the franchise a little bit higher before coming crashing down later. This is often the case.
When a sequel is considered better than the first, right, that's usually a little bit noteworthy, right? And so the fact that you put two in front of one is actually something that caught my eye, because I think usually it is like, oh, they just remade number one. Right. This one must have had something at least a little bit more meaty.
Yeah. And then here we get to the top 6, and these would be movies that I really, really liked. These are the equivalent of the ones that earned A's.
Yeah.
And first up, a 2017 film with 3 Oscar nominations and 1 win for supporting actress. The movie where Margot Robbie was really robbed of a Oscar nomination. Number 6, I, Tonya. Before we dig into this, we've touched on the fact a couple times that we are both big sports fans. But here's our last chance to revisit the topic here. So, and let me make my big admission, and this is just a weird confluence of the way words work sometimes, but there is a word in fandom that applies to me in 2 separate ways. Because fans of J.R.R. Tolkien will call themselves ringheads, but also fans of the Olympic Games also call themselves ringheads, and I qualify on both counts there. So, before we talk about the movie, where do the Olympics, winter and summer, fit into your world of sports fandom?
Yeah, I'm more a winter than a summer guy. I don't know if I get quite the thrill of track and field as other people get. I think winter has such weird, eclectic or crazy events that I love. So
do not bring your biathlon hate here. That is not welcome.
Yeah, biathlon, skiing, and target shooting, right? I mean, like, I watch that. I can't get enough. Yeah. And the rules are so strange. Like, well, you didn't hit enough, so you get a delay, right, before you get to go skiing.
You have a ski penalty.
Yeah, so I love that. I love curling. I love hockey, so I'll watch all of the hockey games that I possibly can. And I actually find figure skating an intriguing one to watch. There's usually sometimes there's, and we're going to hear about it in this, like a little bit of bad blood or a little bit of rivalry and that sort of stuff. So I do love the Olympics, and I love the fact that it's now, unlike when back when you and I were kids, right? And it was here's the tape delay from Tokyo,
exactly,
right? Now you can watch it like 24/7, and you can go to the curling channel if all you want to do is watch curling. So I think that's I really find them super entertaining.
You know, I was riveted to this story, the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan story, when it happened. And I have to say, I was a little nervous about the film, just in terms of sort of how elitist it might be or how overly mocking the tone might be. Tonya Harding and her family and friends, there's a lot mockable about them. Also sort of how accurate or inaccurate the film, you know, could be in dealing with those events. But this is, it's a great film. I think it straddles the line of telling this wild story of wild people in wild circumstances. But I think Tonya Harding is portrayed with at least some level of sympathy. And that's really what I appreciated about it. Again, the sports stuff wasn't bad, especially the behind-the-scenes stuff, the sports mom, Allison Janney, you know, all of those sort of behind-the-scenes elements. That's really where the story was, and I think the filmmakers understood that.
You know, we talked about 42. Obviously, I wasn't alive when the Jackie Robinson story unfolded. Mm-hmm. But like you say, I was rapt to the television about this, right? I like lived this story. You know, Nancy Kerrigan, right out of Massachusetts, right? She's a local New England girl. She was like the princess, right? So, so like you, I also thought, which way is this going to go? Is it going to be overly sympathetic to Tonya Harding? Is it going to be overly crude about Tonya Harding? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be like a, you know, a lashing of her? And like you say, I think it just sort of tells the story, and it tells it in a way that's sympathetic. Her life is not easy. No. And so to say, like, I am excellent at something and I can barely get out of my own town, get out of my own way, mm-hmm. all of those sort of things, I thought, like, really brought home, it's admirable she got as far as she did. It's sad that her boyfriend clubbed her rival, right? Because the truth is, like, she might not have even needed it, right? There was at that point that, like, is this, you know, flowing or is this, you know, athletic? And I think if you look at time, it's become more athletic. Now it's more about who's doing the quadruple lutz, not the triple lutz. It's not about, that's a lovely layback. It's about they're putting together complicated jumps all in a row, which is much more Tonya Harding than Nancy Kerrigan. Right. And so, you know, I think history might look back at her as like she was a pioneer in some sort of way that was tarnished. I really loved this movie. And like you say, Margot Robbie and Allison Janney are just fantastic in it. And is it Sebastian Stan? Is it?
Yes, that's right.
Right? It's Bucky as Galooly. They're all very good at this. I thought this was very good.
Yeah, they're so well put together, start to finish. Really, really enjoyed it. And then we get to our first of two Best Picture nominees from just last year. Number five, Top Gun Maverick. And I will mention just one weird element about this before I gush about all of the good stuff. And that was, it's really weird to watch a movie with so many clips from a prior movie.
Yeah.
I mean, if you add it up, I don't know, six, eight, 10, I mean, it seemed like 10 minutes. It probably really wasn't that many, but it was kind of weird how often they went back to show you literal clips from the first movie. But that was the only sort of weird, off-putting thing about it.
My friends growing up, like, loved Top Gun, loved Top Gun. And I kind of never loved it. I kind of was like,
it was,
I don't
know.
Yeah, right. I don't understand why everybody like really loves it. And then it becomes one of those things like when people say like best movie ever made, it's like, oh my God, it's an F. So it's a little bit of that expectation sort of thing, right? Like, you know, no, that movie sucked. It doesn't really suck, but because you love it so much, which I think is a terrible thing about fans sometimes. And so I went into this one, like I've only seen this one once. I sort of said like, I didn't really like Top Gun. I'm intrigued to see where it is. And where this goes. And again, I thought it was good. I don't know if it was great. I certainly don't think that it was like, this is best picture worthy. Yeah.
On that, I would say this is the kind of film the Academy had completely in mind when they expanded from 5 to 10.
Yeah.
They were hoping that a film like this would be made.
Yes.
A big, well done, big budget crowd pleaser, and that it would be nominated.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's clear Cruise is having a lot of fun with it. I think Jennifer Connelly is a fascinating character to bring into it, based upon the one mention of her character, I think, in Top Gun, right? So it's like, oh, they've really got their continuity sewn up. But I don't know if I would put this at five. This seems like a middle of the pack to me.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I like that every penny shows up on the screen. So I think it's well made, again, from that technical standpoint. And it's a crowd-pleasing story. It does, and this, not to put words in your mouth, but this may be where you are. To me, it brushes up against the line of being overly cheesy a few times. And to me, it manages to stay on the right line of that.
Yeah.
Number four, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. This one is enough to almost make me forget the... Well, what was that other one? It was like 40 minutes ago. Did we? I don't even remember.
I don't think we got made.
I think we started at number 20. I remember specifically we started at number 20. And other than that unnamed movie, it's been a pretty good episode for Harrison Ford. He's in one of the Expendables, Last Crusade here. He's in 42. You know, he's doing all right for himself. And to me, this one is just great. And to make the comparison to Crystal Skull, Indy relating to someone much older than him was much more fun than someone younger than him. And Shia LaBeouf, no offense, but you're no Sean Connery.
I'm going to ask you one question. Of the Indiana Jones movies, is this your favorite?
Raiders by far.
Yeah. It's so funny because I think that there really
This is second.
Yeah. I think Raiders is near perfect, if not perfect. And I think this is near perfect. So this is two, but clearly two after Raiders. There are plenty of people that put this above Raiders, right? Yeah. Like it's either Last Crusade Raiders or Raiders Last Crusade. Nobody puts Temple of Doom number one. Yeah. I think this movie is great. And I think what I like about it is that all of the Indiana Jones movies kind of build on each other. So, you know, Temple of Doom is a prequel. It takes place before Raiders. Right. And he's like, I'm going to give you the ashes of this emperor to get a diamond, right? That is not somebody who says that belongs in a museum. Right. And so his character kind of grows over these things. And I think you learn more. And so what I liked about this one a lot was you got a lot of backstory about him through this interaction with Sean Connery. You hear about how, like, the dog was named Indiana. We have that opening, sequence with River Phoenix, right? And so I really think this one is superb. I will watch this one every time it's on, obviously, and I think it's great. I will tell you one factoid, which was the 20th anniversary of Raiders. They showed the three Indiana Jones movies back to back to back at the Wang Theater in Boston. And so you showed up at noon and you left at 8 because they had time in the middle for like lunch and things like that. And it was just fantastic. And the guy who played Sala was there for a question and answer between 2 and 3.
Oh, I love it.
So it was just a fantastic day. But I absolutely love this. And I think Sean Connery crushes it. As the senior, and the fact, like, you know, again, I'm going to gush a little bit, right? Like, you know, Dad could never do this. Dad hates rats, right? So, he's afraid of snakes and he's afraid of rats, and so I just think this is near perfect. Love it.
Agreed. And you know, as good as this episode, this discussion has been for Harrison Ford, it's even better for Sean Connery because here he is with another film in the top four. It's the second James Bond movie from Russia with Love. Again, I think the main difference between this and Dr. No is that they seem to know how to make more of a Bond flick at this point. And it also has the Cold War aspect of a film, which again is what I want from that era of James Bond films. And that, frankly, is a little bit of what makes the Bond films a little tricky, you know, these days, you know, not having that Cold War element. This one was very, very good. Spoilers for whenever the next time I do one of these episodes is, I have since watched Goldfinger, and it is currently at the top of the next list, but only a few films in. But I'm just saying, I really love both of those both of those two.
Yeah, this one is great, like for all of the reasons that you say. I do think that real life political tension of the Cold War just folded so neatly into James Bond movies and spy movies at the time. It always fascinates me that like one of the biggest villains is a middle-aged woman who has a knife in her shoe. But overall, I think this one is great. And I do think it's appropriately above Dr. No, because like you say, this one feels more like a complete meal, right? You know, this is like they figured out the spices to put in. It's not just meat and potatoes.
And we mentioned that Top Gun Maverick was nominated for last year's Best Picture Oscar. And here at number two, we have the winner, Everything Everywhere All at Once. And when a movie has so outlandish a premise, so many outlandish premises, you just have to commit 100% to making it work. And they do. It's really the most challenging, mind-warping, strange, entertaining take on parallel universes or parallel realities. And man, Michelle Yeoh is just perfect. A deserved Best Picture award, I'd say.
Yeah, we're talking about Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I agree with you. The interesting thing about this was it was out in theaters and I was like, oh, I've heard that this is pretty interesting. Like, I'll wait to see it. And then my middle daughter like called crying and said, I just saw this wonderful movie, Dad. I know you love movies. You really need to see this movie. And so it struck her enough that she picked up the phone and called me, right? Which tells you movies can be powerful when they're very, very good. And this whole movie about how have you wasted your life where you are? And what would have happened if I broke up with that person, right? Or never got married or personally like asked for a divorce earlier in life or any of those sort of things. And to see how in different universes, how that plays out, even to the ridiculous of like in one universe where rocks with googly eyes, right? Like it can really get bizarre. And so it's not only this challenging relationship of husband and wife, but it's also, and how that impacts the daughter and the relationship between the mother and the daughter. I just thought this was beautiful. And to see, like for me, the biggest scene was in one universe, her and her husband are both Hollywood megastars.
Right.
And the megastar husband goes to her and says, you know, I just wish there was a life where we owned a laundromat and we're struggling doing our taxes, which is the universe that this woman is trying to escape.
Exactly.
And here's this megastar who's saying, like, I wish that I had something more simple just to be with you. It's like you say, if somebody elevator pitched this, I would be like, you're high. Like, why would I give you money to do this? I may as well throw the money out on the highway. You know, I think you're right. That commitment of story and the actors, the fact that I can't even pronounce his name, but the gentleman who played Short Round, he plays so many different characters. Believably, I just thought this one was beautiful. I just really think it's beautiful. And I can see what your number one is, and I can understand why that's number one, but this deserves number two. This is just perfect.
This is one where you're saying when you walk in to the studio with the pitch, you need to have your storyboards with you too. This is one that you can't just say, here's my 5 minutes, I'm going to explain it to you. There has to be some visual element in order to convince those wallets, I think, to pry open, much less to get the performers on board and everyone else on board. It is so visual. You know, I kind of feel sorry for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, you know, being on the same list as this one. That probably dropped poor Cumberbatch a few spots because, okay, seriously, we're going to do parallel universes? Hold my beer.
Yeah, and you know, I do think that when you look at multiverse movies, even if you look at something like the Spider-Man one where they brought back Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, a lot of those seem to be like, oh, this is going to hit you right in the nostalgia. And after a while, it's like, you know, there's only so much you can go to that well. This is such a fresh take and such a personal take that, you know, it's not only, oh, look at this wild universe where the daughter is a pop star, right? It's understanding that mother-daughter, husband-mother relationship. And for people my age who have gone through stuff, it resonated in a lot of ways, which I think is probably why it resonated with so many different people, right? Yeah. You know, you wouldn't think a movie like this would be universally lauded, or even, like, I'm sure if I asked my dad, watch this movie, he would be lost.
Right? But, sure.
But the fact that it was universally loved, I think just shows you how powerful the message was.
Yeah, and I think one thing you said, it's a movie that focuses on adults with adult relationships and all of the connections and weirdnesses and freaking heartbreaks that adult relationships, family relationships, friend relationships, all of that entails. It's beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And my favorite of these 21, my favorite vampire movie ever, Billy D, are you listening? Number one, Let Me In. And I can't remember who the director was that I heard say this, but a famous director was once asked, how you make a great movie? And the answer was simple. Have three great scenes and no bad scenes. And to me, that's what this movie does. There's nothing wasted. No scenes that are poorly executed, that are padding. No scenes that serve no purpose. And there are at least three great scenes. And I love the concept of this movie, which is that vampires need human helpers. That's part of the deal. There was a comic book series that dealt with this maybe a decade ago called Daymen.
Huh.
Those would be the human helpers, the Daymen, the people who do what the vampire needs while the sun is up. That movie focused on sort of almost the managing the businesses and the finances and doing those things for the vampires. But in this one, if someone doesn't know, the vampire is a teenager, albeit one hundreds of years old, is played brilliantly by Chloe Grace Moretz, and her new friend who ends up in that role. And he's an introverted, bullied 11, 12, 13 year old. I have more to say, but if you've seen it, give you the chance.
I think this is fantastic. If you haven't seen the original Swedish, yes, Let the Right One In, I think they both work. And I agree with you. The thing that I love about this is, one, innocent looking young girl who is undead, evil vampire. And it's kind of told from the bringing in of the new thrall, mm-hmm, and the aging out of the old thrall.
Right. You get both sides of that.
Yeah. And I think that, like, for me, I had never, ever even thought about that, right? Like, yeah, what do you do when you're too old to bring her the food that she needs to, like, mm-hmm, right? Because they show him, he knocks people out and brings them to her. Or if he hasn't been able to procure anything, he bleeds himself and gives her some of his blood. But he's getting too old to do the job. He's like, he looks like he's in his mid-50s, right? And mm-hmm, and so she just recognizes that it's time to do that. And it's really painful because you can see he is still in her thrall. He doesn't
right,
want to,
yes,
I don't want to give up the job. I can still do this. I don't know if he says he loves her, but you can tell he is 100% devoted to her and his role. And he can see her moving on. So there's almost like a love story, right? Like these two people are growing apart and she's falling in love with somebody new, except she's evil. And what she's doing is making this guy, this boy, her thrall. And of course he is a picked on kid who is looking for acceptance. And so of course he's going to fall into her clutches in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. So it's really a thinking horror movie. Yeah. Like there's, you know, at one point there's a scene, I don't know if this is one of your three great scenes, but at one point there's a scene where the older thrall has not been able to procure her anything. And so she's like, I'm hungry, I have to feed. So she's in a little like tunnel in a park, pretending to be hurt. She's a young girl. This person trying to do good shows up and says, can I help you? And she just eviscerates him. And so it's like the first time that you see on screen, like, she's an animal. It's cinched home how terrible she is, in a way that I thought was like just unbelievable. You can watch this on a million. It's a vampire movie, no doubt. It's a horror movie, sure. It's really this heartbreaking relationship story. And it ends with the new guy he's in. And so you go, oh, all right, we're going to see this story play out again in 50 years, right?
Yep.
You know, so it was very heartbreaking in some sort
there's
of way.
Such an, it's just, like you said, there's just such an inherent sadness to it. And a weird creepiness because of, I mean, it is literally grooming for this specific task, for this purpose, you know, using him, you know, completely for this. One of my favorite scenes, very subtle. There's a outside external shot of the hospital. And if you look close enough, you just see her climbing up the outside of the building and climbing into the room. I guess that's of the elderly. The older, you know, the guy in his 50s, the guy is basically done, really had nothing else to contribute. Wait a minute. I like to think of him as 107. And if that's okay, can we just do that instead? But I thought that was the one that it's advertising how subtle it's going to be in that moment. And then there really is a wonderfully victorious, gruesome scene towards the end when the bullies get their comeuppance. It's the swimming pool scene. It is almost like, well, there she is being a hero. She's saving him, but we know the rest of the story too.
Yeah.
He doesn't. He only knows this part of the story. We know the whole story. It's just a doozy. It's just a doozy of a film.
I will say, if people haven't seen it, they should see it. And they should see both versions. I think they're both.
Yeah, agreed. That doesn't always happen, that both versions are sort of equally strong. Different enough, with enough similarities well. All right, and last chance. Of these 21 are the ones that you've seen, you know, don't need your whole list. But again, what do you think your top three, top five would look like, that sort of thing?
Let Me In, Everything Everywhere All at Once, and Indiana Jones would be in the top five. I think Speed Racer has to be in the top five. I just love that movie so much. And then I think it's going to be tough. I think 42 is excellent. I think I, Tonya is excellent as sort of like a biography. It's hard to say no to James Bond. I think I'll say 42. So it would be Speed Racer, Let Me In, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 42.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, you know, thank you for bringing your film fandom to bear on this episode. Appreciate that.
We'll talk about films and movies. So whatever people think. Oh.
So, well, there we go. Some more movie talk and with a guest. How about that? So, Doctor, when you're not watching old-timey black and white movies or doing that side hustle of yours in the emergency room, where can listeners find your thoughts and interact with you?
Well, I'm still on X or Twitter at DrAnge70. And from a creative point of view, I still run my Supergirl blog, which is called Comic Box Commentary, where I review all of the Superman titles, but with a specific focus on Supergirl.
Thank you. As always, a pleasure to have you here. Pleasure to chat with you.
I love the show. I love talking to you. And I love the fact that you invited me on for this, because I do think that movies are a big love of mine and I don't get to talk about them that much.
I would love to hear your thoughts on this episode, on any or all of these 21 movies, how embarrassingly incorrect my opinions are, which of these 21 would be your number one and or your number 21. Whether Ange should boot me out and take over these movie countdowns totally on his own. Or at the very least, tell me how badly I messed up the order of the Bond flicks, the Expendables movies. Just set me straight, okay? And just for everyone's information, the original five Planet of the Apes films are currently on my DVR. So next time we do one of these episodes, that quintet of movies will be on that list somewhere in some order. Feedback can be sent via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com. or as a comment on the Twitter or Facebook post for the episode, or directly on the blog. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and take care.